Lieutenant General James Dubik, U.S. Army retired, writing in the Army Magazine, the magazine of the Association of the U.S. Army, writing under the title, Consider These Seven Factors Before War Ends. General, thanks for your time today. You write, an in-process review is necessary if we're serious about ending the post-9/11 war in a way that both creates a better peace and secures U.S. strategic interests in the process. We'll talk about each of these 7 points in a moment. But why is it, sir, that you believe that an in-process review is necessary at this point in time? Thank you very much for joining me today, sir.
Welcome. Thanks for your interest. Well, I believe it's necessary because there are some who believe falsely that the war is over. It's far from over. And if we are going to have any reasonable chance of success, however we define that, we should take stock of what we have done for the last 14-plus years, identify what's worked, what has not, and structure a way ahead that is reality-based rather than ideologically based.
You say, however we define that, the conclusion of the war, and it strikes me that that ties directly into the first point that you write about, which is creating a coherent strategy. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of military strategy is that you want to understand what the conclusion is, how you define success as you're building that strategy. Am I correct on that, sir?
That is correct, but I think it's more than a military strategy. I think the same thing is true of the other elements of the strategy that will be necessary, diplomatic strategy to close the opportunities for these guys to move around the world, governmental strategy to help the governments in which these guys are operating improve themselves so that they take the wind out of our enemy's sails. It's also an economic strategy, an information strategy. So it's the military and non-military strategy that has to be correctly aligned towards some vision of a future, more than just defeat of ISIS and al-Qaeda.
The second point that you write about in this piece is to go on the counteroffensive, and you write very plainly, wars are won on the offensive. That's not where you see us today, correct, sir?
I do not. We are certainly taking some offensive action, like drone strikes and special operations raids, but these, in military language, are merely defensive spoiling attacks. They're ways to keep our enemy away from us as we defend ourselves. And while these attacks are necessary, they are insufficient to succeed in achieving some kind of vision of the future that's satisfactory for us and secures our interests.
Are they, do you believe, the first successful pieces of a puzzle, or are we just not even going in the right direction at all, sir?
No, I think they are necessary. They're going to be continued to be part of a larger strategy. But until we figure out how to act in a way that decreases the amount of land that our enemies have now seized, controlled, and govern, and threaten, and until we figure out how to make sure that they cannot continue to erase sovereign borders, these kind of decapitation strikes and raids will be pinpricks leading to nowhere.
The third point that you write about is get boots on the ground, and you write, the Army must make the case clearly and forcefully for ground forces being essential to ultimate success in our war, and once more, the Army must be ready to expand. Your comment there coming at a time where the debate is really how small the Army will get, sir.
And that's really why I made it. Sooner or later, we're going to realize that we cannot stop al-Qaeda, ISIS, and their ilk from taking more ground, controlling more territory, threatening more governments by our current foolish, in my view, a priori policy of no boots on the ground. I'm certainly not talking about redoing the surge all over the world. That would be equally foolish. But to take off the table right off the bat preemptively, any kind of boots on the ground reduces the dilemmas that we can pose to our enemies.
In the fourth point that you make, sir, you cite the Department of Defense Military Personnel Act as one of the issues that's causing you to say that we should add leaders. That's point four. What types of leaders do you believe the Army needs right now, sir?
Well, the kind of wars that we're in are leader-intensive. Every time you add a group of people to go forward and train others, you have an increase in numbers of senior sergeants and mid-grade officers. Every time you send a headquarters to war that is not a standing headquarters, you add senior sergeants and mid-grade officers. Every time you send a unit to war, it has to be augmented to be 24/7 capable. That costs mid-grade officers and senior sergeants again. And right now, because we have the wrong leader-to-lead ratio in our force, we are robbing Peter to pay Paul. Those leaders come from somewhere. And when they come, when they're robbed out of existing units, it reduces the capacity of the units that are left.
Do you have the confidence that those leaders exist within the Army now and just aren't in the right places? Or does the Army need, in your view, a very high capacity, very quick leadership development program to accelerate the people it's got in the pipeline already?
Neither, actually. I think that the leaders do not exist now, and they haven't existed because we fought a global war without growing the Army and the Marine Corps sufficiently. So the numbers of senior or sergeants and mid-grade officers do not exist right now and will not exist unless Congress authorizes the ground forces to expand to increase the leader-to-lead ratio. Once that's done, then the services can acquire new leaders as necessary. They know how to do that. And they can retain the mid-grade officers and senior NCOs that now they have to let go in order to maintain the mandated leader-to-lead ratio.
Lieutenant General James Dubik is writing about seven factors to consider before the post-9/11 war ends in the Army magazine. You can find a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Point five that you make, sir, is to prepare to adapt, and it strikes me as an observer that that's been the most difficult one during the post-9/11 war for the Army to get its arms around. Is that fair on my part, sir?
Well, my view was that the adaptation was less necessary at the fighting level and more necessary at the strategic level. We don't seem, as a country, and the Army is part of the strategic dimension of that country, to have adapted correctly to the war that we're in. The fighting forces have adapted, and we've seen that in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and certainly seen it in the special operations forces. But at the strategic level, we're trying the same things over and over again that have not worked. And I think my challenge to the Army was the senior leaders in the Army should do all that they can to change that approach and to adapt at the strategic level and help the nation adapt at the strategic level.
The sixth point that you make is enforcing cost standards. And one of the potential changes that some of your uniformed counterparts who are still in service are looking for is the ability for uniformed leaders to have more influence over things like the acquisition process, requirements writing for weapon systems, and so forth. Do you think that those efforts will be helpful in enforcing cost standards and will contribute to what you'd like to see in this point six, sir?
Well, they would be helpful, and certainly our acquisition process, the problems with it are well documented. But also associated with cost is the exorbitant cost it took even to feed people in theater. When I invaded Haiti, for example, we ate MREs for the first 2 or 3 months. And then afterwards had fresh food brought in, but nowhere to the standard that I experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think we, in our correct desire to care for troops who are fighting on our behalf, we've gone a little overboard. And I think it's time to set realistic standards in this regard as well.
You write, reasonable cost per soldier standards must be established and enforced. Commander proficiency at expeditionary fiscal management must improve. Stewardship continues even in war. You address the first point there, sir. The second point, commander proficiency at expeditionary fiscal management, where's that learned, sir?
Well, it's learned on the job, mostly, and especially at junior levels. The fiscal management skills are not normally part of the repertoire of behavior we expected of them. But when we give thousands of dollars in more, in some cases, to junior level leaders in local funds, which are exactly the right thing to do. We owe those commanders an equal amount of training to make sure that they're used wisely and accounted for properly.
The seventh point that you write about, sir, is building conventional capacity. That might sound like a bit of an anomaly when we think about some of the weapon systems that, not just the Army, to be fair, that other branches are looking at. The idea of two soldiers' feet on the ground is maybe not getting as much focus, or at least not as much high-profile focus as it has in the past.
Well, my points were actually two. First, while it is the case that some form of hybrid warfare or war amidst the people, whatever we're going to call them, is most likely to be the kind of war that we face. First, this kind of war contains elements of combined arms warfare. And it's not just hearts and minds. Rather, there's a lot of fighting involved, and we should acknowledge that fighting. Second, again, while the hybrid warfare might be the norm, the exception, conventional warfare against another state, remains a real possibility. I mean, North Korea hasn't gone away, China hasn't gone away, and Russia hasn't gone away. As we go forward, the challenge is to build a force that is both capable of doing what's is most likely expected, hybrid warfare, but embed in that capacity the ability to go to conventional warfare if that comes up.
General, you write to wrap this piece up that we are in inning three, you believe, of the post 9/11 war. Why do you believe that's the case, and what's important to consider for the remaining six innings, sir?
Well, I borrowed the phrase from Brigadier General retired John Brown, a friend of mine, and whether we're in inning two or four, I don't know, but we're at the beginning of this war, not the end. And that was the point I wanted to make. And the issue about what's necessary going forward will rest upon a realistic, hard-nosed appraisal of where we are. Look, we started this war, and the initiative was with us in reaction to the 9/11 attacks. We quickly eliminated the Taliban regime. Following that, we quickly eliminated the Saddam regime. Then the initiative shifted, and it shifted to the enemy. From 2003 to 9 in Afghanistan, the initiative was with the Taliban. In Iraq, the initiative from 2004 to 7 was with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We re-seized the initiative during the surge and then gave it away in 2011. In Afghanistan, we seized the initiative back in 2009, but now it's up for grabs. So when you look at the 14 years of war, I see it as a sine curve, and I think that what will happen in the next six innings is also up for grabs, and it'll depend on whether we learn better than our enemies.
General, thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on this piece, and I appreciate your insight.
Thanks a lot for your time and interest, and good luck to you.